Hi everyone. Let me just first ask if there's any general questions before I start. I'm going to review the lecture from last time a bit. Okay. Oh yes.
I was confused during the tutorial between the difference of peculiar velocity versus co-moving peculiar velocity. I don't know if you could explain the difference.
Oh right. How did I phrase that in the tutorial? I d actually confess that I don't remember using either of those terms, so I.
Oh, I'm not sure there are directly questions about them, but we're using the concept to try to dissect.
Oh, I see. The peculiar velocity is. Cosmology usually means physical distance or physical time. Call that V phys. So that's the quantity that would appear in, when we made the statement last time that the physical momentum goes as a to the minus one. Then this quantity is what would appear here. It would be not V fizz over. But then you should keep in mind that this is going to be a. If you write the quantity dx dt, where x and t have the same general meaning as in the FLRW metric, x is a co-moving distance and t is proper time, then there's a factor of a there because this is. Because a times dx is, maybe it's clear to write it like this, times a co-moving distance over physical time. Yeah, I guess this came up in the tutorial, right? Because out of this statement, you'll solve for V physical, but then to convert that to a trajectory in the FRW spacetime, you'll need to know that that's A times dx dt. Sorry, is this what you were asking? Is that?
The difference between that and the co-moving peculiar velocity is what I'm confused on.
Oh yeah, so a peculiar velocity I would define this way, and the term co-moving peculiar velocity, I'm actually not sure if that's a standard term, but if I were reading that term, I would think it would be defined this way.
I'm reading, it's written that way in the notes where it distinguishes the two.
In the Bauman notes. Oh, I see. Sorry. I guess I should be paying more attention to the notes. So I am going to guess without looking at the notes that peculiar velocity means this, and co-moving peculiar velocity means dx dt. The question was a wake-up call that I should be paying more attention to the notes so I know how he's defining things.
I had a
Yes?
related question about the co-moving frame. So what's the relationship between a co-moving frame and the proper time frame?
Co-moving frame is, a frame where if you if your co-moving coordinates are constant, then you're a co-moving observer in the co-moving frame. And then, you know, a boosted frame would be one where dx dt is non-zero. Now proper timed for me means generally, you know, if I have some world line, then the proper time is, you know, the time experienced by an observer that carries a clock along the world line, which I suppose you could write this way. Yes, okay, that's what I thought. okay, thanks, Kazel. Yeah, so this is what I was guessing, that peculiar velocity means physical distance per physical time. Co-moving peculiar velocity means co-moving distance per physical time, and the two are related by a factor of A. Okay. Yeah, and so in particular for a co-moving observer, the proper time is the same thing as the FLRW time coordinate t. Are there any more questions? So I'm going to start. So one thing I realized I forgot to say last time is that I'm generally using units where h bar and c are normalized to 1, and also the Boltzmann constant when I get to thermodynamics. But I won't normalize the Planck mass, or equivalently Newton's constant, to 1. I'll leave those units of mass, or equivalently inverse length. And I use the metric signature minus plus plus plus. As you saw when I wrote down the FLRW metric. So last time, the first few lectures are really definition heavy. So I like to just kind of start every class by reviewing the definitions from last time. So first, the definition of the FLRW metric, parameterized by a function a of t, which is called the scale factor. And that parameterizes the expansion of the universe with time by supplying the conversion between physical distances and coordinate or co-moving distance, which I'll now indicate without a subscript because that's the default when I write x. The Hubble expansion rate is defined to be the fractional increase in a per unit time. And this is a number around 7 times 10 to the minus 11 inverse years, meaning in every year, the universe expands by 7 times 10 to the minus 11 fractionally. And it's just defining that time scale is usually an intuitive way to describe time derivatives. And so we just tend to trade derivatives a dot for factors of h in equations. For example, when I wrote the Christoffel symbols, I just denoted them with h's instead of a dots. We drew some FRW light cones. So in these coordinates, co-moving distance and physical time, or equivalently proper time experienced by a co-moving observer, the light cones don't go at 45-degree angles, but have slopes proportional to 1 over a. Do the conversion between, maybe a clearer way of writing it is to first write it this way. It's the same equation as before in response to a question where I convert from dx over t, which is co-moving distance per unit time. I convert that to a physical velocity, which is physical distance per unit time with a factor of 1 over a. And then if the trajectory is light-like, then the bfiz is equal to 1 so that you get 1 over a. But if you wanted to think about a time-like trajectory, for example, a time-like geodesic, then you could substitute some other form for the physical velocity and figure out the trajectory. And then we analyzed the geodesic equations and found that geodesics in the FLRW spacetime are generally described by the rule that the physical momentum decays as 1 over a for both the light-like and the time-like cases. That would tell you how the energy and the momentum of the particle evolve. In the time-like case, by converting the spatial momentum to a velocity and plugging into this equation, you could integrate the trajectory. So in particular, when applied to photons, this statement that the, for a photon, the frequency decays as 1 over a, is the famous redshifting effect. It says that if a photon is emitted somewhere on the pass on your pass light cone, and then you see it when the scale factor has a different value, that the frequency that you observe is the frequency with which the photon was emitted times the ratio of scale factors between now and then. And this denominator, A obs, if the observer is us today, then that's 1 by definition. So the earlier a photon was emitted, the lower its frequency is today. Let me also say, just to give one more definition, that physicists usually parameterize the expansion history with the scale factor A of t, but astronomers usually use a different variable, the redshift z of t, which is defined this way. So there's no real difference. They refer to the same thing, but and a physicist would say when the universe was 1/3 of its current size that the scale factor was 1/3, and an astronomer would say that the redshift was 2. I'll always use A in the class, but you'll find Z written a lot in more observational papers. And this, of course, is how the expansion of the universe was first observed. It's something that was predicted when the FLRW metric was written down, and then observed a few years later by Hubble, I think, is the astronomer who gets credit. Who found that as you look out further and further into the universe, then you see this redshifting effect. The way that you observe the effect is that you know, if you look at any astronomical source which is emitting a narrow spectral line, so this might be a cartoon of intensity as a function of frequency. Say I'm looking at a line-emitting galaxy with a bunch of spectral lines. Those spectral lines occur at characteristic frequencies. And so if the lines are narrow, then you can tell if they've been shifted over by some factor, you know, A or 1 plus C. Even if the shift is small on the order of, you know, say 0.1% or so. In fact, astronomers tend to think of, from a physical point of view, I think it's sort of natural of thinking of time as being the natural variable to parameterize our past light cone. The expansion history A of t, the scale factor, as being something that's derived. But observationally, A is what we observe through this redshifting effect. When we see a distant source, it's often easy to tell at what redshift or scale factor along what value A or Z had along the past light cone where the source was observed. But we usually don't have a direct way of measuring like how many light years ago the light was emitted or how, the co-moving distance to the source or anything like that. So in observational papers, you often find A or Z just used as the time coordinate everywhere instead of time. Okay. So the main thing, so that's a review from last time, plus a few comments about the how we derived the famous redshifting effect. The main thing that I want to talk about is curvature and Einstein's equations. So I'm just going to, so far, I didn't really tell you how to derive the scale factor A of t. I drew a picture of what it looked like, but I didn't explain the physics that gave rise to that picture. And that comes out of Einstein's equations. So we'll take the Einstein equation and specialize it to the FLRW metric. Einstein's equations generally have derivatives of the metric on the left-hand side and stress energy, like energy densities on the right-hand side. And so when specialized to the FLRW metric, you will get a differential equation that says how A of t evolves in as sourced by stress energy. And that equation is a famous equation, Friedmann's equation, that we can integrate to get the evolution of A of t. So I'm going to go through that calculation. It takes a while to work that out. I like to start by, when I introduce GR concepts, to just review the GR a little bit. So I'm going to do kind of a mini review of curvature and Einstein's equation before specializing to FLRW. So let me first remind you of the definition of curvature. If you take the definition of the covariant derivatives that we wrote down before and apply it to a tensor, say a tensor with m upper indices and n lower indices, then after some algebra, one way of discovering curvature is just to compute this. And you'll find that what you get does not involve any derivatives of t and can be written in the following way. So for each upper index, you'll get a curvature term. Note that in flat space, the derivatives would commute, hence the name curvature. So you'll get a term like this. Let's see, there's m term is where the upper index moves over. As usual, there's only one way to contract the indices. You just need to remember the signs. For curvature, it's a minus sign for upper indices and a plus sign for lower indices. Where the curvature can be written this way. Here I have to admit that I have to look at my notes to get the signs correct. So that's the definition of curvature. Put that on its own board. And there are some identities. I'll just write down a few lines of identities satisfied by the curvature tensor. So there's some permutation identities that are nicest to write down if you lower all of the indices. So the Riemann curvature tensor is anti-symmetric in its first two indices. That one is evident from the definition. It's also anti-symmetric in the last two indices, which is not apparent from the definition, but is easy to work out. And then finally is symmetric under swapping the first two indices with the last two indices. And then I'll barely use the next two identities in the class. I think I'll just refer to them once or twice. But if I'm writing down identity is satisfied by the curvature tensor, it just feels criminally incomplete not to write these so-called Bianchi identities. So the first identity says that if I take the curvature tensor and I take the first three indices and I cyclically permute them, that and I sum them, then I get zero. And then the other Bianchi identity is the same thing, but with a covariant derivative in front. So that's everything that I'm going to say about the Riemann curvature. The Ricci curvature, I guess for us, will arise more often because it's more connected to Einstein's equations. The Ricci curvature is just obtained by self-contracting the Riemann curvature to get an object with two fewer indices. It follows from these permutation identities that this is the only way up to sine to self-contract the Riemann curvature tensor. If I chose a different pair of indices to self-contract, then I would either get zero or something related to Ricci curvature via sine. It also follows from these identities that the Ricci curvature is symmetric in U and Nu. I'm going to write down a little formula for Ricci curvature. That is going to be the starting point in a minute for deriving Friedmann equations. I guess that's all I have to say about Ricci curvature in my general GR review. And then closely related, there's the scalar curvature, which is the just obtained by self-contracting the indices in the Ricci curvature tensor. One minor comment is that, I use the metric sign convention with three pluses. If you were to flip the signs, use the other convention, then the Riemann curvature, let's see, the Christoffel symbols, the Riemann curvature, and the Ricci curvature would all stay the same. You would not flip the sign. R is the first object that we've written down that does get a sign flip under this change. And so you'll find it written, different books use different sign conventions, and so you may find R written with the other sign and the opposite sign in some references. And then finally there's the Einstein curvature. Which you can think of as like the trace reversed Riemann curvature tensor. If you subtract a multiple of the metric chosen to reverse the trace or the associated scalar curvature, that's how you go back and forth between Ricci curvature and Einstein curvature. So one interesting property of Einstein curvature that's not at all obvious of the definition from the definitions is the statement that its divergence vanishes. Let me write it this way. So this is true for any metric. It's just like sometimes the term kinematic identity is used for a statement like this that doesn't have any physics in it. It just follows from the way that variables are defined. All the identities that you would need to prove the statement are on the board. It follows from the definitions of the various curvature objects combined with this identity, which relates different covariant derivatives of the curvature to each other. And then finally, there's Einstein's, the last equation I want to write is Einstein's equation. Okay. Let me point out then that Einstein's equation only makes sense if the divergence of the stress energy is equal to zero, because the divergence of the Einstein tensor always has to be zero for any metric. So stress energy is conserved. This identity that the divergence of the stress energy tensor is zero is the generalization of the usual law of conservation of energy and momentum in Minkowski space to an arbitrary space-time. It's necessary for Einstein's equation to make sense if you tried to solve Einstein's equation with a non-conserved stress energy tensor on the right-hand side. Then you would just have a mathematically inconsistent situation where Einstein's equation has no solution. So that's all I'm going to say about, there's a lot of kind of formal structure of GR packed into this, these few blackboards.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
So far, if we define everything the way you did right now, we're ignoring the cosmological constant. Are we doing it for simplicity, or?
Oh yeah. I find it simplest to include the cosmological constant in the stress energy. I guess not every reference makes this choice. It seems simplest to me when we write down the stress energy in the standard cosmological model shortly. It'll be the sum of terms for matter, radiation, and so on. And then there will be a term in there which is just proportional to the metric. So with my sign conventions, there would be a minus sign here. If you did not want to put the cosmological constant here, then you could include it as a separate term. I suppose it's a matter of definition whether you put the cosmological constant into the stress energy or into Einstein's equation.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So specializing this general GR machine to the FLRW metric is largely an exercise in mechanical calculation. So I'll calculate the Ricci tensor first and then the Einstein tensor. So the Ricci tensor as usual, this calculation will split up into different cases depending on whether indices are spatial or time. I'll go through in detail the calculation where both indices are time. So if I take this general definition and specialize to the case where mu and nu are both time indices, then let's see, maybe I'll write kind of a I think I'll do this. At the risk of putting in too many steps, I'll just put a step where I specialize mu and nu to be zero. And now we'll go through and start thinking about which terms are zero or non-zero. The first term happens to be zero when we calculated the Christoffel symbols last time. I think I still have them on the board. These two Christoffel symbols are the only two that are non-zero. So the Christoffel symbol with two zeros is always zero. In the next term, I get something non-zero if both of the rows are space-like. So then I get H delta II, the result is here. In the next term, oh, sorry, this should have been 0, 0. This term 0. And then in this term, I get something non-zero if both indices are space-like. So I'll write that as h delta ij times h delta ji. And so then this contraction, delta II, gives a factor of 3. And then it's not, I'm sorry, I made an algebra mistake. This delta function I wrote with the I and J reversed. If you guys see algebra mistakes, please heckle. So there's one combinatorial factor of 3 in the first term and another factor of 3 in the second term. And the final result is going to be written this way, 3h dot minus 3h squared. The remaining pieces of the Ricci curvature can be calculated similarly. R0i is zero, and that can be concluded with no calculation, either by rotation invariance or by parity invariance. Rij is non-zero. It's I squared times h dot plus 3h squared. Yeah, h dot plus 3h squared. Delta ij. I may assign this one as a tutorial. It's similar. Before doing the calculation, you could have inferred from rotation invariance that it would be some function of time multiplied by delta ij. Okay. Then, the next step in running the GR machine is to calculate the scalar curvature, which will be minus 1 R0, 0, 0 plus a to the minus 2 delta ij Rij. Let's see, so this is 1 times 3h dot plus 3h dot minus 3h squared. Plus 2 times. Now if I collect terms, I'll get, there's a factor of 3 here when I contract the delta functions. I'll get 6h dot plus 12h squared, yeah? Okay. And then finally, oh yeah, I guess I should continue over on this side then. Okay, and then the last step in this celebration of mechanical algebra is calculating the Einstein tensor, which turns out to be G00, just and you end up getting h squared with no h dot term. And for Gij, you get minus a squared times 2h dot plus 3h squared. Okay. So that was pretty mechanical, and that's the going to be the left-hand side of Einstein's equation. To talk about the, I'll put these equations in a box because I'll need them in a bit. To talk about the right-hand side of Einstein's equation, I need a few more definitions. I haven't said much about the stress-energy tensor in an FLRW metric. So let me start by writing this equation. This equation is partially a definition and partially a statement about symmetry. Okay. So I claim that the stress energy tensor in an FLRW cosmology can always be written this way, where rho of t and p of t are functions of time. Rho of t is the energy density. And p of t is the pressure. Generally speaking, in GR, notions like pressure or shear or mean velocity are encoded somehow into the stress energy tensor. I wrote the stress energy tensor with two lower indices, but if I had raised the indices, then this a squared would be an a to the minus 2. So this is partly just definitions of the quantities rho and p. Then there's also the statement that in an FRW cosmology, the stress energy tensor must have this form, like with the zeros and the delta ij. And that follows by a symmetry argument. The first part of the argument is just to notice that the stress energy tensor must have the same symmetries as the FLRW spacetime itself. Namely, rotation and translation symmetry. That follows by Einstein's equations. Since the metric has those symmetries, so does Einstein's tensor, since it's derived from the metric, and therefore the stress-energy tensor, since they're proportional. And then you can sort of convince yourself that the combination of, for any tensor with two indices, the combination of rotation and translation symmetry implies that the tensor must take this restricted form. I'll just kind of walk through and give the argument in words. The rotation symmetry means that components of the form T0i must vanish. Just like the Ricci tensor, for example. And similarly, in the space part, you must get something proportional to delta ij. Based on rotation symmetry alone, then I suppose you could still, these prefactors could still be functions of both time and space. And so the last step is just noticing that because of the translation symmetry, they must be independent of x. But they could still be functions of time. Okay. So now, with this expression for the left-hand side of Einstein's equations, and these definitions of rho and p to put on the right-hand side, I can set them equal to each other. And so I'll skip a line or two of algebra and just summarize the result. You get two equations, one from the time piece and one from the space piece. The first equation looks like this. It says that h squared, this one you can read off with no calculation. On the left-hand side of Einstein's equation, I have 3h squared. And on the right-hand side, I have 8 pi g times rho. The second equation needs a little bit of algebra. When you write down Einstein's equation, you plug in the first equation and do a little algebra to write it in the following way. Actually, let me write this just to make it look a little nicer. Let me write it as a dot over a squared instead of h squared. The second equation is usually written this way. Times rho plus 3p. So the first one, sometimes called the Friedman equation. And second one is Friedman's second equation. Okay. There's one more equation that I'd like to specialize to the FLRW metric. That's an equation that I wrote down before, but I forgot to write the name, which is the conservation of stress energy. So you can see that I want to specialize this equation to the FLRW metric. The equation has an index nu on the left-hand side, for a free index. If I take nu to be a spatial index, then I'll get zero by symmetry. So I may as well set that to be a time index. That's the only case where I'll get something interesting. And so then I'll get one equation that, let's see, I'll write it like this. I'll do this one in detail. So when I do this covariant derivative, I'll get the partial derivative term plus two Christoffel terms. This term. And the term where the zero moves over. So in this line, I just wrote out the definition of the covariant derivative. In the next line, I'll think about which terms are zero or non-zero. So here I get, in the first term, I get something non-zero only if the mu index is a time index, since ti0 vanishes. In the second term, same thing happens. And then for the mu index, I need something spatial to get something non-zero. And then this term, see, I might notice first that the Christoffel symbol is only non-zero if I do two spatial indices. And then I'll have the two spatial indices here in T. And then in the next step, I'll start plugging in Christoffel symbols and stress energy elements. So this is going to be the time derivative of rho. This is going to be H delta II times rho. This will be a squared h delta ij times a to the minus 2 p delta ij. Okay. And then this gives 3h rho plus 3hp. And so this equation, is usually written this way. It's sometimes called the continuity equation. And it's just the law of conservation of stress energy specialized to FLRW. One little comment is that if you do a little algebra, it's possible to derive the continuity equation from Friedmann's equations. You could see how that would work. If you imagine that you want an expression for rho dot, then you could start by differentiating this expression, and then you'll get that will create some a double dots on the other side that you'll then plug in using Friedmann's second equation. That's a general statement. You can always derive the conservation of stress energy from Einstein's equation. Because as we mentioned before, Einstein's equation generally contains the statement that stress energy is conserved because the divergence of the Einstein tensor is always zero. It's also possible for I don't know if this is some sort of generic feature of GR or something that's just true for FLRW, but if you take the first Friedmann equation plus the continuity equation, you can derive the second Friedmann equation. So when thinking about the evolution. I like to take the continuity equation plus the first Friedmann equation as the equations of motion and sort of temporarily disregard Friedmann's second equation, which will automatically be satisfied. This way of writing the equations is nice because you have two first-order equations, an equation of motion for A that has rho on the right-hand side, and then an equation of motion for rho that has A, or rather its derivative, in H, and rho on the right-hand side, plus a pressure term. There's no equation. What's missing if you want to evolve these equations is a like an equation of motion for P, or some statement about how the pressure is derived. Generally speaking, if we have some prescription for the pressure, then we can evolve these equations of motion and find the expansion history. Without some idea of what P is doing, the equations are incomplete. Different cosmologies more or less amount to different prescriptions for the pressure. I'll start. Let's see. So in the next lecture, I'll start considering some different cosmologies, starting with, oh, I guess I only have 5 minutes left, so I won't quite be able to do it today. Just to give you sort of a concrete example, the first example I'll consider is a constant W cosmology. One more definition. The equation of state parameter W is just defined to be the pressure over the energy density. It's called the equation of state. And a constant W cosmology just means a space-time where the stress energy is dominated by a single fluid. By a single component. With constant W. It's kind of a toy model, but it's already physically interesting. So this will be a model with one free parameter, namely W. But some choices of physical interest are W equals 0 is pressureless or non-relativistic matter. And we describe that as matter, which is cosmologists speak for non-relativistic particles. Don't have pressure because their velocities are small and they're just moving on co-moving world lengths. The case W equals 1/3 is the case of radiation, which is the cosmologist term for relativistic particles. A constant W cosmology with W equals 1/3 would be a universe full of photons and no other sources of stress energy. W equals -1 is the case of a cosmological constant. I won't justify these values of W today, but we'll talk about it tomorrow. Our universe, the Lambda CDM cosmology, is a case where you just have all three of these components contributing to the stress energy in some linear combination. Okay. I guess that's it for today. We have a couple minutes left, so does anyone have a question before we break for next time? Yes?
You said those in actual cosmology, those three components all contribute to the stress energy tensor.
Yes.
I wasn't exactly sure what the third component means, because I know that the first one is just the matter. And
oh, yes.
Like photon, but what does the third component mean?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I guess I've been saying the term cosmological constant without really defining it. So here's a formal definition. Is that this definition is probably not the best place to start, but a formal GR definition is that it's just a contribution to the stress energy tensor. Let me put this symbol to mean that it's, you know, one of several terms in the stress energy, which is just proportional to the metric. A little more concretely, you can think of it with a minus sign here. And so a little bit more concretely, you can think of it as one where the energy density, or T00, is constant in time. In contrast, the energy density of a uniform density of non-relativistic particles will decay with the expansion of the universe. If the number of particles is conserved and their mass is conserved, then as the universe expands, the energy per unit volume goes down as 1 over a cubed because the volumes are expanding. The cosmological constant just means that there is a contribution to the energy density of the universe, which stays constant in time and does not dilute with the expansion of the universe. It's, of course, a famous observational surprise. I think there was a lot of, it was discovered in 1990 or so that to explain the expansion history of our universe, you needed to add a term like this to the stress energy. At late times, it becomes really important when the stress energy of all the particles in the universe has diluted, then the cosmological constant takes over. It drives extra expansion of the universe by appearing on the right-hand side of Friedmann's equation. Prior to the discovery of the cosmological constant in 1990 or so, I believe there was a lot of sort of theoretical bias toward thinking that it had to be zero. But now we've gotten used to it. Yeah, thanks. That was a really good question. Okay, would anyone like to ask another question? Yes?
About the continuity equation, we know that you mentioned that if with the first equation, the continuity equation implies the second Friedmann equation.
Yes.
That is there other usefulness for this of this continuity equation?
Yeah, I suppose it's like not, it's not really independent of Friedmann's equations. We didn't have to write it down. It's sort of implicit. I think it's useful to just sort of have in the library of equations. It gives a constraint on the stress energy that needs to be satisfied for mathematical consistency of the FLRW metric. It says that the time derivative of the pressure of the density is sort of controlled by the expansion history and the pressure, I suppose. But there's kind of like no constraint on P dot, or you know, P is kind of allowed to behave in an arbitrary way, not that doesn't mathematically break the FLRW spacetime. But once P is specified, the evolution of rho is sort of dictated by the continuity equation.